Welcome to the Redemptification Podcast. I've got two very amazing guests today. They're really not guests, but Nelson and Ashley are joining the conversation. This is a part of a series of internal podcasts that we're working, really bringing the listeners into our project and our portfolio here, where we're really trying to elevate the conversations around, you know, hospitality and food and beverage. And Ash, you really have led our group. And I think that's where we need to start, is you talking about hospitality. And even at this week, when I was at NTBA, I was able to share, your definition of hospitality. It resonates with everybody. But, you know, one of the most fun things to do now when I'm in these environments is to ask people what their favorite hospitality experience is. And your answer to that, to me, has always been, it's the best to like hear people try to think through that. And then when I say, well, here's the best one I had, and it's in the home of somebody who loved me, everybody just totally gets it and resonates and agrees. Mm-hmm. So I'd love for you to kind of talk about that and how how you're thinking about hospitality and how you're trying to operationalize that and bring it to scale in our projects.
Absolutely. So I think one of the things I get asked most is about Southern hospitality. There seems to be an expectation of, because we're Southerners, that there's a particular type of hospitality that we give. And whenever you think of hospitality, I think why people have a hard time really describing it is because they're trying to remember what they received in the form of hospitality. But really what it is at the core is it makes you feel a certain way. And so it's emotional. That's why you can relate to it whenever you say, hey, it's whenever you're in the home of someone who loves you and who anticipated you and who knows the things that you need and desire, and therefore your emotional needs are met. It's not that you have the perfect piece of chocolate laying on your pillow or that the temperature is just right. It's that someone literally was so thoughtful to say, hey, you matter so much. I want to make sure that all of your needs are taken care of. That way you can be at peace. So my definition of I thought of you before you got here actually came through just some meditation time of really thinking of why does it matter and why does it feel a certain way whenever we know that we've just been receiving of the best hospitality that we've had. And what I was shown in that meditation was that it's because you were anticipated. And the power of anticipation is incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, a bride, the reason why the groom is so excited for the bride to come down is because there's anticipation, right? Mm-hmm. The reason why it's so exciting to announce a child coming into the world is because of the anticipation. And so when you come to someone's home or their business or their city, and they are prepared for you to meet your needs, you know you've been anticipated and you can relax. And when we relax, we receive so much better.
So good, yeah. You know, I've been adding too. I think there's a second best hospitality experience. And I've been telling people that the second best hospitality experience that I have had is when I meet somebody who loves their place and they share it, you know, from that. And like, and Nelson, you're probably the best at this that I've ever seen about how you can take, a bottle of wine and take a person to that place, and you can speak to that place, you know, in a passion that most people really struggle to do. Like, one, it's because of your knowledge base and how prepared you are and those things. But I think the combination of anticipation, mm-hmm. and bringing people into an experience that, you know, that is from this sense of belonging, I guess, you know. So now, why don't you talk about that, like the way
it's interesting. I mean, I think we're born at such an advantage being born in the South, because we're really the last of the oral traditions in the U.S. I mean, there's some First Nation oral traditions here as well, but broadly the South, we still have stories, and stories make us who we are, and especially within food in the South. And so For me, I mean, it was always kind of natural to approach things from story. I definitely took a lot from, like, the Terry Theis school of thought and what makes wine worth drinking, right? That really, wine is just liquid history and everything else around it is ancillary. But that kind of went from an unconscious thing to really a conscious kind of operational stronghold for me whenever I was building my last business. You know, we have 500 wines by the glass. And if you ask anybody, I don't care who they are, I have an eidetic memory. I cannot remember 500 tech sheets. Certainly can't remember 2,500, which is what we would touch over the course of a year or two. But anybody can remember 500 stories. And so the ability to connect with that, I think, is fundamental and human. And I think whenever people tell us stories, it affords us the opportunity to be pulled into that story, and we become part of it. It changes us on a fundamental level. And so for me, I always start with story, and everything else is sort of an accoutrement of it. Like, if I do, you know, my favorite thing in the world probably ever is dinner. Big, fabulous, ridiculous dinners. And normally, I create the story of the dinner before I get to the cooking. Now, I love the cooking and all that, but I'm never, ever going to serve something that doesn't have a story, because that's just impersonal, and I think our world is rife with people who don't have stories surrounding their hospitality.
Yeah.
So true.
Well, and I think in development, you know, it's so easy to get, we get so fixated on just the business of property, and a lot of developers are trying to figure out this experiential side of food and beverage, you know, and they're looking for plugins, essentially, you know, and I think that's for us, there has to be some, one thing I think it's worth talking about is that there has to be somewhat of a cultural change around the way the U.S. consumes food. Mm-hmm. I actually firmly believe that our commoditization of real estate is directly influenced by our commoditization of our food supply and how it's presented. Mm-hmm. And we're just mere consumers of agricultural products in the States. Whereas in Italy, it's hospitality is an industry, right? It's Ash, you know, when you were there for the 3 weeks that you were there at the beginning of the year, mm-hmm. and one of the first things you came back and said was, why don't you tell the story about...
So my husband and I have been to Italy a few times, and this last time we had the privilege of going for Nelson's wedding. The interesting thing is that this time I was able to pay more attention and be present, and I saw that Italy forces you to pause, is what I said. And it's not in an aggressive way. It's a very gentle and gracious way, because it doesn't excuse why it asks you to pause, because it's celebrating, really, is what it's doing. It's celebrating everything from the history of why they're doing what they're doing, the stories that have been passed down generations on why these farmers are still farming the way that their great-great-great-great-grandfather did it. And, you know, the South has a lot of that. Mm-hmm. One of the most gracious things I can do for someone that comes to Opelika is to let them stay with us at our home, to bring them into our home. And it never fails. If I make a Southern meal, now Southerners definitely know how to flavor things, no doubt. But if I make a Southern meal, I'm making it with the stories that were told to me when I was taught on how to cook certain things. And the simplest thing that I make is butter beans, right?
Yeah.
And it blows my mind every time I make a pot of butter beans. There's never any left. Every guest that comes, they're just so confused and excited about this very simple bean. But the entire time that I'm making it, I'm telling them the process that I was taught by my great-grandmother, that was taught to her by her grandmother, that was taught over generations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it brings something of like this holistic approach. Now you're not just eating something. And you're right. Americans, a lot of times, we just go to eat. Whereas I believe when you go to Italy, what we found was that they pause to dine. They pause to have conversations and to actually celebrate the moment of the work and the love that was put into putting that bean on the table. It's not just a bean to them. It's literally life to them.
You've buried the lead a little bit, because your butter beans, I mean, I don't care where y'all go, what Michelin star, schmuckety southern concept, these butter beans are better. Those things are amazing.
Well, I'll be happy to have y'all on
you
my
said,
house.
You did say something that struck a chord with me. You know, I think when we talk about the importance of food and beverage, specifically in place, nothing can make you more fully present like a meal. Mm-hmm. And I think there's so much conversation around human scale. Like we were just with a designer that I think who focuses on this and has this really superpower of how to think about scale. But, you know, human scale is not nearly as important as human connection. Mm-hmm. And then being present. And I do think that's what, when food and beverage done well, that's what it can do. I mean, when you're, you know, whether it is at the pace of a, you know, a 3-hour meal, I mean, that's almost unimaginable to us in the States. Mm-hmm. To have this course meal. You know, we associate that with a tasting menu. We associate that with a, you know, a very, almost like a pretentious fine dining, but we don't. And then if you think about the categories of restaurants, right, from fast casual, I mean, just the idea of saying fast casual, you know, it's like, well, we're just used to this commoditization of food and this pace and the idea that we're really never fully present. You know what I mean? Well,
what we'll accept in the U.S., I mean, I think one of the greatest illustrations of this is on my bachelor trip this time, so we went to pick up motorcycles, we're riding motorcycles across Italy. And we stop at a McDonald's, the only thing, like, right here where we're picking up the bikes. And I had a Wagyu beef burger on an in-house freshly made bun with DOP. There's a type of prosciutto from Alto Adige called Speck that's amazing. And 6-year-old Parmesan at a McDonald's. Because that's what they have to do to get an Italian to eat there.
I had that burger, too.
It is fabulous. It's
it was like
burger.
A doggone experience at some, you know, Michelin star.
And I had a beer with it at a McDonald's and a great cup of coffee. But, you know, I think this commoditization, the real problem is we don't place frameworks around this, especially in real estate. Like, if I ask you what is a good investment for your real estate, you've got that. Right? Everybody's got that. If I say, okay, what's a good land lease look like for you? If you're a strip mall developer, you absolutely know what that looks like. But if I say, what's a good restaurant? What's a good experience? That makes no sense. And for me, you know, I always filter it through that great old quote, there's a huge difference between putting clothes on and getting dressed. And I think there's also a huge difference between eating some food and having dinner. Mm-hmm. And so I always use, and I'd recommend anybody to read it, Tolstoy's, probably the last of the great moralist philosophers, his, which I'm sure someone will send us an email about Soren Kierkegaard, but Tolstoy wrote this great piece called On Art. It's a little short essay, and what he says is, art, really good art, has a few qualifications. First, it's deeply felt. It is honest. It's truly held. Second, it aims for something beyond itself. It lives to create a change in the world. Third, it communicates that effectively to someone else. And fourth, it affects a good in the world. It moves the world in a good direction, not a bad direction. And now Tolstoy had some ideas about what this is, but I think that's a great hospitality experience. And the problem is, if you just say it's truly felt, it's not contrived, you've cut 96% of restaurants in the world out. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, I think, and why real estate development has such a hard time with hospitality. Also the hilariously narrow margins and the labor pool problems. But that's really where it gets off for me.
Yeah, and I think that it has a lot to do with reproducing it. Yeah. We're so much, you know, I think we get caught up in constantly trying to make systems of everything, right? And that way it can be repeated over and over and over again consistently. And there's beauty to that, and there's need of that in some areas. But there's also a place of forgiveness that needs to be operated in hospitality, especially when it comes to dining. Some of the most beautiful experiences I've ever had with food being given to me to explore is what was available. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that they had everything perfect. It wasn't the most perfect china. It wasn't the perfect temperature in the place. None of that. There was so much intention in celebrating the author and the receiver of what's been put on the table. And you know, one of my favorite places we went to, I believe you pronounce it as Do, is that correct?
In yeah, Italy? Do.
It's spelled D-O, but anyhow, he used his table as his artistic palette. And so what he wanted on the table was anything that was being celebrated from the different farmers or the breweries or the vintners, anyone that he was saying, hey, I'm taking time to take the gifts that I've been given and I want to express how important each one of these items is. The table was his palette. So there was nothing else on the table. If there was something on the table, it was only in order to celebrate what we were actually there to do, which was to participate in great conversation with one another. We weren't distracted by, you know, constant movement happening or things that didn't need to be around us. And we had great food to dine on because it was intentional, not because we were in some pretentious, you know, Michelin star restaurant. We were, but that's not what it was about. And so it was so interesting to see that the same attention, like Nelson was just talking about McDonald's, right? The same attention that McDonald's was forced to give to what they were serving, even though they have all the greatest systems and processes in order, they knew that the client, the customer, the guest on the other side has an expectation of seeing them and an expectation of receiving what is best, not just what could be there because it was the easiest to process to get you out of here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, the thing Italy does so well is I don't think I've ever been in an Italian winery or an Italian restaurant that lied to me. You know, if you flip over the back of a bottle of wine, it'll say, this is cacao nibs and lavender. And it absolutely does not smell like cacao nibs and lavender. It smells like grocery store wine that is garbage. And one of the things the Italians do so well is they understate things. They don't oversell it. They don't overpolish it. And so if an Italian hands you something and they go, this is really amazing, they mean it's really amazing. And I always tell people, I mean, if you want to do, the first thing to do is be radically honest with people in hospitality, because so many of us don't understand that a hospitality relationship, like any other relationship, is based on mutual trust. Mm-hmm. And if you start a relationship with lies, someone will not trust you, and nobody's going to have a good experience. So I think there's the other thing, too, that you mentioned I just want to touch on is this idea of perfection. We overvalue perfection in America. We kind of, you know, people forget that in 1918, the largest ethnic group in America were Germans and Prussians, which is why it was so hard for us to get into the First World War. I think because of that and the advantages of manufacturing and how we won the Second World War, culturally we overvalue specialization and perfection. But I mean, any of us who have kids know that the best thing in our life is deeply imperfect. My child, I mean, she's the other day was just like, it was hollering and pitching a fit and all that, and you just love them to death. And so this idea that you can make something right enough that everyone will love it is not true, because that's not how we are.
Exactly. You know, and I'm take it back to Ty, but one of my sayings that I have at my house, which is a funny one, is when we have guests from wherever, like we have some very special guests at our house right now, right? If I cook dinner and it's just a bomb, let's just say I bomb out on it. It's the wrong flavors. I oversalted it. I burned it. I did whatever I did. My saying is, if you don't like what I have on the table, we're going to stop what we're doing. We're going to order pizza. Now, it's not about the food at that point, because it's like we don't want to get distracted with the fact that it's not perfect. We want to hang out with each other. I was like, I don't want you to be distracted. I can't carry my feelings on my sleeve and be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I didn't get that perfect. I used to be that way. And I realized that that's not what the table's about. It's something that we actually get to do at the table, but really the table's about communication, storytelling, crying together, building together, dreaming together. The table's very important. The food is an avenue that gets you to the table. That's not the primary reason at the table.
Yeah, that's good. I think I think we should talk a little bit about trying to bring some practical aspects to the conversation, like how do we do this? Like, how do we actually, as a team, go through? And so we have an opportunity whether it starts with a space or a desire to have some sort of food and beverage activation, I'm sure people are like, well, where do you start? And I think we should go through that a little bit, how we do this. And so Nelson, I'd love for you to kind of tell a little bit, you know, what we call your love letters, right? So how we start with a vision of a concept, or and generally we frame the needs. Like, we know there's going to be some sort of market orientation. There's going to be we know there's a story that's surfacing. And a lot of times we start with an operator too. So there's an operator there that brings their own personality and flavor. But why don't you talk a little bit, Nelson, about how we try to anchor story in the beginning in our concept development?
Yeah, this has been so wonderful. So any of y'all who frequent our stuff or have randomly ended up on my travel email list will know I'm a compulsive writer. And it really came out of a need. So for years, I've adopted kind of a design philosophy to approaching things. So like Henry Dreyfuss, Designing for People, if you haven't read it, I just recommend going and reading that and some Dieter Rams. It'll change your life. But, you know, in design, you always look for hard points. So, for instance, on a car, when they engineer a car, the people who design the body have certain things that can't move. The top of the suspension towers can't move because they're integral to how it functions, right? For us, often the first hard point is a space. We have a building, right, in a community. That has physical limitations. And then you develop more. But the hardest one is, how do we develop a metric for understanding what aligns, right? We always work through spiritual, social, and economic capital. How do we work in, you know, spiritual capital is about ethics, economical capital is about money, but social capital, how do we make things that don't violate the inherent nature of a place? And so the format that I kind of made, and I have a framework for these if anybody's interested, but the format for these we call love letters. And what I do is I tell a little story. So I say, it's about a two-page document, and what I'll do is I'll give some context, right? I'll say, so this is where we are, we understand these things, right? And I set the stage, and then I just tell a little story. And what it creates is, like, imagine if you could just have one set out of one scene of a movie, and you said, this is the most indicative piece of this whole film. Now, you place every bit of dialogue in that, and you see if it matches. Does it fit or does it not fit? And what it does is it creates almost like a telos anchor, right? It creates a teleological understanding of the space, telos being the Greek word meaning the natural end of things, what they strive to be. It creates a space for us to experiment with ideas and see if they really fit in the spirit of what we're doing. And it's been incredibly useful for our team. I'd say they've really kind of moved earlier and earlier, because once you can define the story of a space, once you can create an understanding around it, it's very easy to hold it up like a candle and say, this, not that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been very useful, actually, for us.
Well, I mean, yeah, and I think what it does, I mean, it allows you to anchor design and menu to something meaningful. Mm-hmm. You know, and some of those love letters, too, I mean, it's surprisingly how those initial ideas actually do flow all the way through. You know, sometimes it gets put in the background, the story, and then you can kind of come back later and see how meaningful it truly was. And so it seems almost kind of corny, you know, when you first write them. But it's amazing how it really does. Story does have this really meaningful impact, just like you're talking about with the wines. It anchors you without you knowing that it's anchoring you, in a way, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So Ash, talk a little bit about kind of building up on that. I mean, how you drive, because I think when it's really hard for us to explain these, how the intentionality goes with the concept development, mm-hmm. because what you have, you know, is you've got this really multidisciplinary thing going on that's being pointed at something seemingly small, like this food and beverage application, right? I mean, it's a lot of intention going into what is maybe, you know, could be a $500,000 to $1 million investment. So how we kind of segment from like concept development, story, menu development, and then ultimately design, mm-hmm. and the advantages of having all that kind of curated together versus what would typically probably be siloed roles, you know?
Right, right. So the thing that it helps me with is, first of all, I believe I do more of an emotional architectural type design. How does the space really, you know, not just speak to me, but what is the stories that actually existed there? And then you touch on that when you go into the love letters that you're writing, because you're actually saying, hey, not only are we talking about the story that existed, but what could the story be? And I believe that's the beauty of it, is that it gives us a runway, Ty, to say, hey, we recognize and honor the past, but if we wanted to really honor this space and this this proprietor or this investor that has asked us to walk along with them, how do we actually take this space and say, what would it have been had it kept going? That is something that John says. And so when you think about that, the greatest thing is to let people understand how to own that. When people start telling the story and they are a part of the story, they're in the family photo again, so to speak, mm-hmm. they get excited about it, and I can pull from that. I can pull from that in the ways that they bring me other stories. They bring me more about their personality. They bring me more about what do they really desire to see happening, not just in paint colors and textures, but in how they want to feel. And it goes back to the place of hospitality. People want to feel like they belong. They want to feel like this is for me and this was done for me. And so for me and the design team that we have here, which includes Nelson and yourself and Natalie, we really, I believe, are just, we're having that kind of tug of war in ourselves to say, how do we really make sure that we show up, that it's more than just the spreadsheet that has all the numbers on it perfect so we don't get outside of budgets. It's more than just making sure that we are honoring the contract to the degree of the scope that we agreed, or in the scope that we agreed to. It's how are we really going to impact this culture, this environment, these people in this place that we're going to show that they matter. Because if they don't feel like they are a part of the story and that it's something that's for them, they're not going to stay a part of it. Well, not one person that I've ever met wants to go somewhere that they don't feel invited and loved and cared for.
One thing you do that I think you've always done, and I appreciate it so much, is you make declarative statements with design. Definite statements. And, you know, a declarative statement invites someone to either agree or disagree with it. And so many people are doing the design version of a bucket of room temperature mayonnaise. I mean, there's just nothing going on there. And they're dying of design botulism as a result. And so what I love is, like, you, one thing you taught me is it's not to be afraid of color. So, like, I just painted, I live in the first house that y'all ever did, the house I grew up in. And my wife and I are renovating. Actually, we bought it from Ty. It's kind of passed through everybody back in the family. But this big old historic home, all of those rooms would have been painted like biscuit in the 1860s, right? But it's my home now. I have ownership of it, which means I make statements of things I love. And so my wife told me she wanted a red room. So I took one of our front rooms, and it has 14-foot ceilings and big windows, and I painted every inch of that thing high-gloss Chinese red. Walls, windows, ceiling, trim, everything. And it is the most fabulous space ever, but it's because if you don't want to be in a red room, you're going to hate it. But if you do want to be in a red room, it's amazing. And it has something to say, which is so refreshing in what I can only call a Lollapalooza of mediocrity that defines American spaces. And, you know, I always think if you want an accent, well, you really want to paint the room that color. You're scared of doing it.
Take a minute.
But that's what I love is, I mean, you make declarative statements in your design that invite people to either inhabit them or not. And I think so much of what people see that we do that is that is what they're impressed with, what they really love, is the uncompromising nature of our approach towards beauty. And now that makes all kind of frustration and everything, and it's expensive and it's hard and all that, but it also creates a lasting value that transcends mere fads. And that's why, I think it's safe to say there are spaces that you designed 10, 12 years ago that you can still walk into and say, this is a beautifully designed space.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, I think it's important too to bring that, how we execute design. I'll talk a little bit about this and let y'all add color to it, but we've kind of coined the process. We call it a bridging process, where we start with the schematic level of a floor plan. This is after we understand the menus, understand the story. We get a floor plan that includes generally that we believe that the operational flow is right, everything from, you know, the guest flow to the kitchen flow to, you know, all those things, working really closely, you know, with the operator, the chef, to do those things. So then we have this kind of anchoring floor plan that shows the elements. But then, you know, what, Ash, you do so well is I think you create through revealing a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, you really do, you work through texture in a way that only somebody that could be, that's like truly present in that project could, mm-hmm. you know. So we hack, in a lot of ways, we hack the design based on a palette that's already existing. Mm-hmm. We like to say we demo our way to value, right?
Right.
And we only get there by tinkering a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And so there's a, there's a tension that exists. You know, it's an intentional inefficiency in the design process, the construction process. We intentionally don't go through like the normal stages of design that goes from, you know, concept to schematic to design development to construction documents. Then those construction documents have to be translated and priced with trades who are siloed. We have to be, we try to hack that, you know, to try to ensure that we get more out of the existing space and of the design process. And really the one advantage you have here on our projects is you get to treat our guys like your fingers. When we go other places, that's more difficult.
Sure.
And so we have to do a lot more translation, and the things that we've kind of learned is like, we have to identify pretty early the skill sets of the trades and the team on the ground. They're, you know, we have to do a lot of coaching to make them almost convincing that, hey, we need to have flexibility mm-hmm. with, you know, the trades, meaning like we may buy, you know, we may agree to buy the materials direct and to buy the labor so that we're not constrained by, you know, how we procure these projects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And which allows us to try to bring some of the magic with us when we, you know, when we come. And I don't know if you can kind of riff off that a little bit, but
I will do my best. You're right. I do sometimes wish I could take our team everywhere with us. And mainly it's because we have found that there's a difference between people that work on new build and the craftsmen that actually work in these old spaces. One of the things we have to really practice is not being perfect. These buildings are beautiful and imperfect in every way that we can find. And they bring incredible challenge to actually problem solve every single day. And what we are tinkering, because we're trying to figure out what's allowed, because it only lets us do so much in order to honor its integrity, right? So when we take that other places, there is a level of difficulty to it, but I believe what we bring in a genius way is that because we're still actively, presently going through that work process daily in our own project, we can bring a strong sense of empathy and we bring wisdom. And that is so valuable over even being able to nail the straightest wall or frame the straightest wall, I think, or to lay that out on one of your beautiful CAD programs or whatever to say, this is exactly how this room should be built. there's something about being able to stand in that and have the ability to speak into it. It's empowering to be able to speak into it with empathy and wisdom because we're currently doing it. But one of the things I believe now that you touched on, just going back to color and what you're saying, Ty, a little bit, is having flexibility in design is the key. Having flexibility in hospitality is the key. And so when Nelson was younger, it's funny to me, when he was a young boy, he really detested writing or penmanship. And penmanship is actually a precursor that you have to embrace before you can actually be a good writer, yes. Right? And so Nelson rejected every format that I put in front of him. And whenever he did that, I ended up figuring that, hey, if I just allow him to be who he is, then he can show up greater. So instead of putting him at a formalized table with a white piece of paper that's, you know, got a standard college rule and this pencil and it's sharpened like this and you hold it like this and you write the letter like this, I let him have freedom. Gave him black paper, gel pens, and let him have freedom in how he would do that. That's what we're doing, honestly, is I gave him a constructive advice, I gave him a direction, and I gave him boundaries that he needed to stay within in order to learn, in order to perform. And I believe that's what we do when we go to these projects. It's the same thing.
And for all of you moms who are recoiling right now, I have fantastic penmanship.
Yes,
I write in Spencerian longhand. But no, I'm just saying. So just lest you think it's chicken scratch all around. But that it's true. You have to give people license and liberty to do things. And I tell you, any of y'all that are in development, first, if you are any of your vendors, if you're not their favorite person, you are not doing cool stuff. When we show up places, our vendors love us. Like we just did, we've been doing a lot of work with PPG recently, the paint company. And I've used their automotive paints for years. My dad used them before that. And they really technically have the best products for coatings in the world. And so I showed up there recently and I said, hey, I need 50 gallons of the brightest colors you've ever seen. We did this wall with these big stripes. I said, I need oil-based, extremely high gloss, very vivid colors. I said, and will you let me mix the color? Will you let me come back there with you and mix the color? Man, it was Christmas for them. You know, if you ever go to a paint shop, look at the splatters on the inside of the shakers. That tells you what they're mixing a lot of. Gray, beige, grayish, you know, tan, taupe, white, maybe black if you're crazy. I mean, and I just came in here and asked them for a kaleidoscope of hot pink, bright orange, OSHA safety yellow, and it made their week, but it's giving people the license to live to the best version of what they do. Or even with our welders, you know, we have some fabulous, fabulous welders. We're building all these huge, incredible steel windows, and I've recently joined the International Guild of Window Restorers, and it's a great group. And so I said, hey, could you build me a window like this? And I drew him a set of plans. I said that this is a window that would last 200 years and be beautiful. And the way that that makes them feel to get to do their best, to get to bring their best, is huge. So I'd say a great metric for me always is, are you giving people license to act in their brilliance? Because I promise your subs are better than you think they are. If they do something for a living day in, day out, they have within them the ability to do something truly beautiful. And they want to, but we have to give them the license. And then we have to stand almost as a vanguard between the capital and the actual construction and allow them to build things that last and have meaning.
Yeah, and I think that's where the challenge is, because, you know, you want to go in with this fixed pricing. You want clarity of pricing a lot of times, and I think we've been effective in budgeting. So we kind of design to budget, so I think that is the tension, you know, is that, you know, just from a practical standpoint.
So could you just for a second, Ty, because you're very good about this, could you talk a little bit about how you act as that interim layer, how you can help protect our subs? A great example, I think, of this is oftentimes we have an amazing guy we call Vega who works for us, and he can build anything. He's a master craftsman. But a lot of times master craftsman means going slow. And quite often, you'll make extra space with other subs for him to be able to do something that he knows is the right way to do it. How do you hold that intention with a deadline?
Well, I think first of all, it starts with scoping, you know, like, and making sure we understand with the trades where the stops and stops, where the starts and stops are, and where the scope gaps are going to exist, and then bringing clarity to that. So I'm going to answer your question indirectly, but a great example of this, you know, we were just working on a project yesterday, and is the bar. Okay, so every restaurant has a bar. Most of the time, the bar is going to have it's going to have some distinct finish and detail on it that's both operational and design oriented, and you hope that those are designed with some creative fabrication, right? So if you think about the traditional construction process, you know, if we were to want to, if we were wanting to execute this great bar with a typical, you know, draw bid process, we'd have to detail every piece of that. We would have to kind of figure out every, you know, piece of the materials.
There would be instructability too, right? Because the framers would frame the bar and then you'd wait a month and then they'd come back and do the drywall on the front of the
bar. It's the thing, it's just a scoping thing, is that this is how, you know, this is why a lot of people don't do this stuff, because it's hard, you know, like you have to hold the tension. And so what we do is we find like the typical materials. Hey, the die wall, build the die wall, we're going to frame it, and then you're going to have sheetrock. And then we're going to, you know, put the, maybe it's, you know, the plywood top. And then we say, all right, that's general trades, you know, stop. And then we take more of a design build approach where we can come in and say, okay, this is the mood board. This is here's how we want to fabricate this. We generally sketch the details. And then that's where we invite the larger conversation, because we don't really know. We know what we want and we know what the vision is, but we don't know the genius that's in the trade until you ask. And so, but you have to have the platform to do that. So that's normally what we do, is we scope it, you know, we get a bid, we budget the custom fabrication, and then we go to those trades and say, hey, here's what we want to do. Tell us the best way to do this. And so, for example, you know, like if we have something on a bar that's got a curve or, you know, a radius on it, and we've got these unique things, they can tell us like, hey, well, this is how, this is what we'll need from you. Like, these are the questions we're going to have. This is how we're going to cut these segments. You know, how does that impact your design? And then we can pivot to that. And so then it's an orchestra, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the thing, is it, but most people, again, it takes intention, and we've taken a lot of that design build approach out of construction. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think in these food and beverage concepts, there's a lot of opportunity for that. And so but it's sometimes, you know, you have to, it doesn't seem like the juice is worth the squeeze. But it really, I mean, it really is. If you want a really unique and interesting project that's designed forward, you're gonna have to be willing to be curious with your trades and bring people in that can do fabrication and work with a lot of different materials. Mm-hmm. To get good outcomes, especially in these historic buildings. Yeah,
you're exactly right.
Well, I think this is gonna have to be a part two. We talked a lot about, I think it was great to talk a little bit about how we see hospitality. I do think, you know, for the next conversation, we can maybe even go a little bit more detail about the stages of how we develop these concepts, how we kind of have three or four, what we call go, no goes, mm-hmm. how we build to the decisions. And really, we can talk more about alignment of investor, building owner, and operators. And I think that would be an important conversation. Mm-hmm. But I thought that today was great. So I appreciate the conversations, and we look forward to next time.
Thanks, Ty.
All right.